This is the KOTO Community Radio News for Wednesday, April 3rd. I'm Gavin McGough.
And I'm Julia Caulfield.
In today's headlines, Tourism Board rolls out fresh marketing for town.
Telluride Talks 5G.
Radio Book Club returns with the next chapter.
And a mountain weather forecast.
The town of Telluride has resumed marketing itself as a destination for the first time since before the pandemic. The Telluride Tourism Board oversees those efforts, and the board's executive director, Kira Skinner, was at town council this week to share their progress as the summer booking season is heating up. Skinner reports potential visitors to Telluride might see our canyon popping up on their screens.
So we'll have 30-second videos, 15-second, as well as 7-second that will run on connected TV, as well as pre-roll video online and paid social. So video has performed very well for us historically. So we're running with that and using these concepts and really making them come alive.
Those concepts brand Telluride as a distant, heavenly location, inviting potential tourists to, quote, dip their toes into the clouds and, quote, wander beyond their imagination. In addition to casting a broad net over potential visitors online, the TTB pursues targeted outreach to international markets, who often spend big on Telluride vacations and come for a longer duration, making international tourists a bigger bang for our buck. Skinner says their outreach efforts landed Garanos on The Sunrise Show, Australian TV's top morning program. She offers town council a clip.
Look at his snout and his chest. It is ridiculous. It is dry and fluffy.
The renewed focus on marketing aims to keep Telluride relevant in an evolving travel industry. Skinner says national trends have mixed messages for the American travel economy going forward.
Excitement for travel is still very high. Fear of a recession is at a post-pandemic low. However, travel costs are a top deterrent to travel currently, and we will see international travel continue. So as we did last summer, people may opt for Europe instead of visiting domestically.
While Skinner highlights initiatives that will promote Telluride in the season to come, she also takes a moment to look back at trends from our winter here in town. Overall, it was a pretty standard season. Total destination occupancy, which includes both Telluride and Mountain Village, was a touch down from last winter, 4% reduced. Telluride was down 11%, indicating the loss in traffic was concentrated in town itself, not the village. Here's Skinner.
You know, a real cause of this, the year-over-year decrease in winter occupancy is the early season. And I think everybody knows December and January were pretty slow. And really, I think it's due to lack of snow, delay of the ski resort opening. And we did have a reduction of group business in early December, which I think also contributed to that.
Council member Ashley Von Sprecken says that slow start is becoming a reality of the climate change era.
The winters are not as snowy as they used to be early season. And I'm just curious, you know, obviously, we're not going to have any control over that or what Telski chooses to do with opening the resort or how much of the resort is open.
If we can't fix climate change, Von Sprecken wonders, can Telluride's ski-centric appeal adapt?
I'm just curious if we've kind of started looking at a different strategy for that early season marketing that maybe doesn't center around the ski resort and the skiing, because that's not going to be a reality for us.
Skinner recognizes the need to diversify Telluride's offerings as our winters evolve. Whether or not tourists catch on is hard to say. Also, on the topic of diversity, albeit of a different note, Councilmember Ellen Levin chimes in as she reacts to Tourism Board marketing materials.
I just want to make the comment that in all of those illustrations, I think making sure that we have some diversity represented in the humans that are included in that would be great.
Skinner agrees. It's on TTB's radar. And as far as they are concerned, if you can manage to make the trip, book a room, afford the flight, then come one, come all to Telluride.
We've all seen big cell phone or utility towers, an impressively large tree standing on a ridgeline. Those were the cell towers of the past. now they're coming closer to home.
10 years ago, you could have a tower in the countryside that covered 10 miles. You know, it was a big, tall site with really big antennas, but it covered a large area. Now we're at the 5G, which is fifth generation, and everything is coming down to the street level. So the good news is that things have gotten a lot smaller. The other side of that coin is you need more of them because they don't reach as far.
That's Terry Cope with the Toro Blanco Group, a telecommunications company hoping to work with the town on installing a system of small cell, or 5G, towers around Telluride. Cope presented before town council this week.
While we're kind of telecom guys, we generally look at it from that position that we tried to make it aesthetically pleasing, minimally invasive, and a complete win for us would be as if no one ever noticed that there was telecoms infrastructure out there. That's the kind of stuff we'd feel really good about.
When it comes to 5G, the town of Telluride is not allowed to ban the technology from coming into town. State and federal regulations state Telluride cannot restrict a wireless provider, such as Verizon or AT&T, from setting up antennas, but it can regulate what those antennas look like. That's where Toro Blanco comes in. Cope notes the company has worked in New Orleans's French Quarter and Park City to help create a system of 5G antenna that fits within the aesthetic of the communities.
We'd like for the town of Telluride to have the greatest, most advanced connectivity possible. If we can make it invisible, that would be the best way. Can't make it invisible. We want to make sure it fits in and it looks like it belongs here.
In working with town staff, Cope says they've identified a number of sites in Telluride where 5G antennas could go, several along Main Street, a few on Pacific and Columbia. There's some in the Shandoka area and Town Park. Council members are supportive of working with Toro Blanco, but want to continue conversations on how to make the antennas as hidden as possible. Council member Ashley Von Sprecken wonders the cost benefit of fewer, larger towers away from Main Street.
I feel like when I was a kid, we had a lot more like large telephone poles that were really high that especially ran in the alleys. And it feels like that might be a better solution, is to put a taller pole that's off of the Main Street in the alley where those other utility poles are historically were.
Council member Ellen Levin also hopes they can be integrated into infrastructure the town already uses.
We're redoing some of our wayfinding signage throughout town, and I wonder if there's a way that we could collaborate with that effort so that these poles could also be utilized as our like signage posts, so that they're not just like randomly there, that they're also like serving a function that we also need, because right now we have posts that those signs live on.
Councilmember Dan Enright acknowledges that any change to light poles or wayfinding or buildings with the installation of 5G may be hard, but he's optimistic about Toro Blanco's work.
What I've seen and been presented with gives me a high degree of confidence that they are willing to work with us, and I think it's better to act proactively before a major telecommunications provider, Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, et cetera, come in and are less willing to work with our goals for our community.
With that, town council directed staff to move forward with conversations and a potential agreement with Toro Blanco to develop a plan and install 5G towers within the town of Telluride.
We're turning the page into a new month, and it's time for another rendition of our Radio Book Club. Joining us for the April installment is Isaac Ball, who you can usually find behind the counter at Bruno. Ball, a voracious reader, says his most memorable book from the past month is The Passage, a post-apocalyptic thriller by Justin Cronin, which hits close to home.
A lot of it was written around Telluride, which is kind of cool, and I had no idea before reading it. So there's some scientists that discover a virus in South America, basically a vampire kind of zombie-esque virus. And so the army decides to build a military medical base in Telluride, actually, and test it on convicts that are on death row. It goes poorly, and they decide that they need a child whose immune system hasn't been built up yet, so that the virus can kind of live symbiotically with them. You know, everything kind of blows up, turns out poorly, and then it fast forwards about 100 years where, you know, the U.S. is, as you know, it is gone. No radio communication, no army or...
No Kodo?
No Kodo, no radio.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't imagine. So yeah, it jumps around a lot, jumps around a lot of years, and fast forward. The characters, there's this little girl that's 6 when we first meet her, and then 15, 100 years later. So she has the virus, and it prolongs her life, kind of like a vampire. And she's probably the main character, but she doesn't talk too much. And then you have a bunch of people around her that are trying to get her back to this place to fix her world.
Who would you recommend this book to, and who should not read this book?
If you enjoyed watching the show The Last of Us, I think you should pick it up, knowing that it jumps around and it might be a little bit annoying at first to get into. Don't pick it up if you don't like, you know, sci-fi, even though it's pretty relatable, I would say. It can be a little off-putting.
Your parents are the bookstore owners and you work at Bruno. Do you read a lot?
Usually, yeah. I usually have like an easy read that I blow through, and then some nonfiction that I'm trying to, that I feel like I'm learning something. Maybe I'm reading two different fiction books and then one nonfiction. And then I like to mix in some, read a lot of advanced reader copies from the bookstore, because working over there, we get publishers that will send us a bunch of advanced copies before they're published. But those are kind of fun to just pick up and flip through and see if they're any good. And then I can tell my mom to order them.
Do you write ever?
I write some, not enough, but it usually just ends up being me word vomiting. I tend to end up journaling more than actually writing, but I would like to start writing some more.
My last question is, off season is coming up, so do you have a book lined up?
My plan today was actually go to the bookstore and try to pick up a few books. I'm going to the beach and I'm meeting some friends in Mexico, so I told them I'd bring us all some books for the beach. So today my plan was to go by the bookstore and find a good 3 or 5 books to take.
All right, Isaac, thank you so much for coming in today. Where can folks find you if they want to chat about The Passage or any other book?
I'll be around the second half of April and the whole of the off season. I'm sure you'll see me on Main Street or something. I'm often confused for my twin brother, Sam, but come up nonetheless.
That was Isaac Ball discussing Justin Cronin's 2010 novel, The Passage. Ball will pass the baton on to another avid reader who will join us come May.
Buildings are going up at the Meadowlark development in Mountain Village. On Wednesday, Mountain Village and Triumph Development began delivering modular units to construct homes in the neighborhood. Crews expect to deliver 10 modules a day, approximately one per hour. The units will be used in construction of Meadowlark, a 29-unit deed-restricted for-sale development in the Meadows neighborhood. Trucks will be moving the units along Adams Ranch Road, with general traffic being redirected to Russell Drive and Double Eagle Drive. Drivers can expect up to 15-minute delays. The work will run from Wednesday, April 3rd through Friday, April 19th, with work occurring from 8:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. Deliveries will not occur on weekends.
Electric vehicles are on the rise across the country and in Telluride, but those looking for a charge will have to head out of town.
Unfortunately, we will be looking to remove our EV or electric charging units out of that garage probably within the next week or so.
That's Telluride Town Manager Scott Robson. The garage is the Silverjack Parking Garage in the center of town. Robson says the decision to remove the charging station comes after discussions with the Telluride Fire Protection District.
Whereas we're seeing more incidents with EV vehicles around the country having a spark or a fire related to the vehicle itself, it's becoming best practice to not have charging stations kind of down into the interior of parking garages that are under residential units.
Robson notes the town does have plans to install more EV charging stations around Telluride. And there are still public charging stations at the Lawson Park and Ride and Gondola Park and Garage in Mountain Village.
Changes are coming to San Miguel County's Democratic Party. Eleni Constantine is stepping down from her position as party chair, and the Democrats are looking for an individual to fill her role. The party chair is responsible for running caucus and assembly meetings, serving as the point person with the state party, communicating with candidates, and organizing get-out-the-vote campaigns. The chair will join the vice chair, secretary, and treasurer to create the San Miguel County Democrats Executive Committee. Application information is available at smcdemocrats.org.
The Denver Art Museum is preparing to reach out to tribes following new federal regulations regarding possession of Native American sacred and funerary objects. The museum removed a case of ceramics from display in January. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, KSUT and KSJD's Clark Adamitis reports.
Three ceramics and an incised shell gorget, a type of necklace, were removed from a case in the Denver Art Museum. The artifacts had been on display for about a year in an exhibit about Southeastern art. The ceramics were from prehistoric Mississippian and Caddoan cultures, and 30 tribes can claim descent from them today. The items were removed after new federal regulations went into effect regarding the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. The act mandates the return of hundreds of thousands of indigenous artifacts that are in museums and universities across America. Recent updates to the act mandate that items cannot be on display without permission from the tribes.
I do not feel that any of these regulations are a hindrance to our work. We actually think they're a wonderful opportunity to work directly with communities.
John Ludovic is a curator of Native arts at the Denver Art Museum.
We wanted to show a very strong symbolic act of removing these works from the gallery to signal to any tribe out there that we are willing to take this seriously, that we are directly willing and wanting to work directly with your communities.
Dakota Huska also works as a curator of Native art, and she's Oglala Lakota. She says that the recent NAGPRA changes underscore that art institutions are abandoning outdated anthropological practices and are getting better at communicating with Native American tribes.
At the crux of all of this is the fact that non-Indigenous peoples years ago swooped into these communities under the misguided notion of salvage anthropology, that they had to like scoop up all this stuff and study it because Native people weren't going to be here very much longer. And then they would display it and interpret it without any kind of feedback from Native communities. And those days and those ways of collecting are gone now, thankfully.
The Denver Art Museum is finalizing the letter to the 30 tribes that are descendants of the Mississippian and Caddoan cultures. The letter will be sent out this month. The tribes will decide what happens next with the artifacts. For KSUT and KSJD, I'm Clark Adamitis.
A century ago, an electric vehicle made in Colorado was a hit with women. But these days, they're hesitant to buy EVs. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, H2O Radio's Franny Halperin reports on what automakers could learn about studying the past.
In the early 1900s, it wasn't quite clear how automobiles would evolve. There were numerous inventors and companies pinning their fortunes on how we'd get around, whether by steam, gasoline, or yes, even electric cars.
Electric vehicles were about 38% of the vehicles. Steam cars were about 40%, and gasoline vehicles were only about 22%.
That's Rachel Storm with the History Colorado Center in downtown Denver, and we're looking at an electric car made in 1910.
We are standing in front of what Oliver P. Fritchley called the 100-mile electric.
Fritchley built his 100-mile range sedan himself, from its axle and motor to its battery and body. The cars were agile and could even go up into the Rockies, recharging themselves as they coasted downhill. But one of the smartest things he did, he marketed his cars to women.
Fritchley actually found his primary demographic with wealthy Denver women. Molly Brown had one in 1910.
That would be the unsinkable Molly Brown, who survived the Titanic disaster and returned to Denver as a philanthropist.
People always saw her driving around in her Fritchley, and they had a Phaeton, which was the model that he marketed toward women. It's kind of an open carriage type design. There's no top to it. It's kind of the early convertible.
Fritchley's appeal to wealthy women was not only the car's elegance, but also that they could charge it at home and it was clean.
If you ever watch an old movie, they have the crank on the front of the car. That's a gas car. You had to crank it to get it started.
The gas cars created giant plumes of smoke that would soil ladies' dresses, so Fritchley offered them a non-polluting alternative. He had a good run that abruptly ended when Ford developed the electric starter, which eliminated the need for a crank. Still, he was ahead of his time by understanding women.
I don't miss the gas station at all. I don't miss touching those grubby handles that are disgusting and never get cleaned. I don't miss the fumes.
That's Erica Myers, the executive director of Charon North America, an organization focused on standardizing charging infrastructure. She also has a blog called EV Love, encouraging women to buy electric vehicles.
Women make over 80% of the vehicle purchasing decisions for their families.
But according to recent research from Edmunds, women are only around 1/3 of EV drivers. So what's stopping them from going electric?
The way that vehicles, especially EVs, have been marketed up until this point is a lot of things that women don't necessarily care about. So the 0-60 speed, we're not really looking for something like a roadster. We're not looking to drag race.
Early adopters of EVs have been techie types, mostly men, driving cars designed by and for them. Women with families who might want to go electric for environmental or climate reasons really didn't have appealing options.
We still don't have a fully electric minivan.
That could have been a market that somebody could have owned.
Lauren McDonald is the CEO of the data firm EV Adoption.
Because think about it. Where do they go? They go to kids to soccer, the kids to the doctor, the kids to school.
He says automakers have so far ignored the huge market potential women present.
They didn't actually design EVs that would fit with what women were looking for, because they think about safety, comfort, practicality, and pricing and monthly payments.
And beyond the car itself, according to the data firm Geotab, a major reason women aren't buying EVs is safety at public charging stations.
A lot of these chargers are literally located out in some far corner of a shopping mall parking lot or behind a restaurant, and where there's like little to no lighting and where it's unsafe.
Plus, for both women and men, there's an unfamiliar lexicon to learn.
There are literally dozens and dozens of types of chargers and power levels and compatibility and connectors and terminology.
As discouraging as this all sounds for getting off fossil fuels, McDonald says there are many reasons to be hopeful. Several minivans are on the way from Volvo, Honda, and Volkswagen, among others, and charging them could soon get a lot easier and safer.
7 automakers got together and formed a new company called Iona and are building out their own charging network.
A century after Fritchley made his electric car, we're at another inflection point for automobiles. Keep driving dirty gas cars or follow his lead and make EVs attractive to women. It's a move that could help put climate change in the rearview mirror. For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin.
The National Weather Service forecast for the Western San Juans calls for clear skies tonight with a low around 30 degrees. Thursday, expect sunny skies with a high near 50, followed by a partly cloudy night with a low around 35 degrees, and strong winds moving in late. Expect wind to persist Friday with gusts as high as 45 miles per hour. Skies will be mostly sunny with a chance of rain and snow developing in the afternoon. The high is near 45 degrees. There's a 90% chance of snow overnight on Friday when the low is near 20. This has been the news for Wednesday, April 3rd. Thanks for listening. If you have a story idea or a news tip, call the news team at 970-728-3206. And now, a personal commentary.
Hey, this is Mary from the Telluride Historical Museum with your Miner's Minute for April 3rd, 2024. It is the very last week to see the museum's exhibit, Festival Capital of the Rockies, 50 Years of Festivals in Telluride. Don't miss out on this quirky and fascinating history of festivals in the Box Canyon. We are closing for the off-season on April 6th, but until then, we are operating our regular business hours, open from Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., with our last entry into the museum at 4:30. And remember, Saturdays are always free for our locals, even the last one of the season. As we look forward towards the summer, we are hoping to find a sponsor for our very favorite and special Senior Mahoney Day in August. If you're interested, please contact the museum at 970-728-3344 or drop us an email at info@telluridemuseum.org. We look forward to hearing from you. We hope to see you up the hill on First Street soon or follow us on social media to keep in touch with what's up at the museum. Thanks, Kodo. You're a rare medium. Well done.
Opinions broadcast over KOTO are those of the speakers. You are also invited to express your views after the news or on Access each weekday at around 4 p.m. If you would like to comment, please contact a staff person here at KOTO. We encourage you to speak out on important public issues.